So I was home on Father's Day when my friend and fellow journalist, Michael J. Lewis, not the Moneyball Michael Lewis, sent me a clip of his piano recital from that day. Here, take a quick listen. Mike is in his late 40s. He'd never taken piano lessons. But someone recently, he decided, I want to play piano. And now, he plays piano. And it got me thinking. As we age, we lock ourselves into pattern behaviors that become our identities. I'm a writer and a pickup basketball player. She's a cha-cha dancer and a volunteer at the library. He's a this, they're a that. On and on and on. But are we ever too old to try something new? To shift? To change it up? Why, at 51, can't I become Jeff the trombone player or Jeff the rapper?
Dad, no, seriously.
We can all do what we want. We can morph and we can shift and we can certainly reinvent. And we can learn to play the piano. My name is Jeff Perlman. I'm the New York Times bestselling author of 10 books and the host of Two Writers Sling and Yang, the podcast where one writer, me, talks writing with another writer every single week. And today's guest is Laura Carney, the veteran writer and magazine copy editor and the author of a fascinating new book, My Father's List, How Living My Dad's Dreams Set Me Free. And in short, Laura found her late father's bucket list and tackled it item by item. It's riveting stuff. This is episode number 316. Let's sling some yang.
Dad, your podcast sucks.
And nobody cares about your stupid TV show.
All right, Laura. I just want you to know, first of all, I am on my bucket list. I have written down, among many things, sit in my closet on a rainy Southern California morning and interview fellow University of Delaware grad who knows the joy of 3 a.m. pizza on an orange couch in a small college newspaper office while dreading the future. So thank you for being here today. I really appreciate that.
While dreading the future.
You have a new book out. It's called My Father's List, How Living My Dad's Dreams Set Me Free. I have to say, of the 300 plus people I've had on this podcast, it is probably the most unique idea for a book and most original idea for a book, which is to say that your father, Mick, died in 2003 in a car accident involving a distracted driver. It turns out he left behind this list that he created in 1978 that you guys found, a bucket list of things to do. And you decided to do them all and then write about the experience. And it's marvelous and fascinating and insanely cool. And before we get into sort of chasing it all down, I was kind of wondering, you're doing something that seems largely fun and adventurous and cool, and you did over a span of, I think, 6 years. And at the same time, it is rooted in the tragedy of losing your dad when you were young and when your dad was too young. And I wonder if that weight follows you throughout the process of working on the book, or if you're able to kind of put it aside as you're skydiving, as you're riding a horse, as you're meeting Jimmy Carter, as you're doing these different things.
That's a really good question. And I mean, I would say it's probably the latter. I think the weight was gradually dissipating. My friend Art, who's this amazing speechwriter from Canada and also a journalist in his own right, he told me that he always looked at each list item as almost like me leaving more baggage behind with each one that I did. And, you know, when my father died, beyond it being a car crash that seemed tragic in nature, for me, it also brought back the grief of when he moved out when I was six, when my parents divorced, which felt similarly meaningless and inexplicable. So I was almost angry about it too. Like, I'm 25 years old. I've just moved to New York for my first magazine internship. And now this happens. And I hate that I felt angry, but I think as a young person, it makes sense that I did, because it's like, oh, now I have to deal. I don't know how to deal with this. Like, I'm not equipped, you know, and no one around me certainly was equipped. And as I got through doing each list item, I think what was happening more than anything else was I was dissipating trauma, because when somebody dies that way, it's so frightening. You learn at 25, oh, that could be me. You know, that was a teenager who did that, right? So that could be me tomorrow. And a lot of people when they're 25 feel so invincible. And I had a really rude wake-up call that showed me that I wasn't. So I spent a lot of time over the next 10, 13 years hyper-focusing on work and thinking to myself, like, well, if it does happen to me tomorrow, you know, at least they'll say, oh, she was a copywriter at Good Housekeeping magazine. You know, like, I did something. I set out to do my goals and I was successful. And I, not only that, but I was important because there was an element of the way my dad died that made me feel like nobody thought he was important.
Why do you say that?
That wasn't actually true. He was so important to so many people, but the nature of his life was that, you know, I guess I'm realizing like I'm a little bit like this too. He wasn't much of a joiner. So all of his friends like didn't really know each other, even though he was incredibly social and he was a divorced dad. So in a way, I didn't know his life that well, the way I knew my mom's life, who I was with every day. Other than my brother and my mom, I didn't really know who I could share this grief with when he died. And he didn't really have a house he owned. He would rent a room in a friend's house. So it wasn't like there was a home I was going back to where we missed him. I mean, I always think of his home as his car, which makes it really ironic in a way that that's where he died.
Before you get into the book, I do kind of wonder, your dad died because of a distracted driver. You have in the ensuing years sort of gotten very involved in raising awareness about the perils of distracted driving. Again, I know this is kind of out of nowhere. When you are driving and you see someone staring at their phone, texting, what does that do to you?
Well, that's a really good question. No one has ever asked me that, believe it or not. I'm not surprised because you're you. you would be smart enough to think of that. I'm having a very different reaction to it this week than I've ever had before. And the reason for that is because my book's out. And I feel like I did like literally everything in my power that I could do now to raise awareness with this book. I've put something out there on a very big level that does talk about distracted driving in some parts because that's how he died. But for years, I didn't even know what distracted driving was until I guess 8 years ago. And I think most people didn't until about 8 years ago. And what happened was my dad died in 2003. And then for about a decade, I thought he just was unlucky. It was just like a fluke accident. And then 8 years ago, I was sitting at Good Housekeeping where I'd become a copy editor. And an article came across my desk about a man whose daughter died because of a distracted driver. I think the guy was like in a tractor trailer reaching for his phone and his iced tea at the same time. And his daughter was walking in a crosswalk in Ocean City, New Jersey. So, you know, it was very tragic. She was 21 years old. She was a journalism student at Fordham, like a star journalism student. And I just felt like I needed to meet him. And I knew it was like kind of not protocol to contact someone in a story that I was working on, but it felt too important to me not to talk to him. So I called Joel and I said, because it really like it was like a light bulb went off in my head, like, oh, that's how my dad died. She was on the phone, you know, like they cited her for talking, like seven people saw her holding the phone. So I said, I think I know something about this. I wonder if I can help with what you're doing. So he taught me how to speak in schools. And, you know, for the first time, I think since my dad's death, I was starting to feel some agency in what happened and not so helpless about it. And like, and it wasn't because he was unlucky, you know, he was a victim of circumstance because we're living in times where people are prioritizing technological process over humanity. I mean, that's really what it is. Like we have these tools and gadgets that use us as opposed to us using them. And that's not new. Like that's the American way. If you go look back through American history, it's always been like that. Like some new invention comes out, lots of people die, and then they figure out how to use it. So like once I started learning more about that, I started to feel a little bit better about it. Like, okay, this is almost like smoking in the 60s, right? Like you watch Mad Men and you're like, oh, ha, ha, ha. Like they're all so stupid, but they didn't know it then. Back then it was like, we're cool. This is what we do. So I really think right now we're still nearing the end of the we're cool phase. Like this is what we do. And I do really believe we're going to get to a point where enough people understand that it's, you know, beyond the science of what your phone does to your brain when you're using it, it is actually killing a lot of people. And we'll get with the program a little bit more as far as being compassionate. My feeling now when I hear it or I see it is I've done all I can do. I hope that they make compassionate choices. Because what I've learned is the more you tell people don't, like this is bad, there's this weird thing that happens in their psyche that they want to do it more. So I used to do that, but I don't do that now.
I feel like if I were in your shoes, because I'm probably a dick, I would want to be rolling down the window and saying, just so you know, my dad died from a distracted driver. Roll it back up.
Yeah. I've had my moments, especially when I'm walking down the street, because, you know, there was a time there, and this is kind of when I stopped working in advocacy, because there was a time where, and this is like just, I don't know, a weird confluence of events. I had just gotten my first agent and he was telling me, stop doing interviews, like stop doing your public advocacy, because when I roll this out to editors, I want them, you to be like a secret. Like I want them to feel like they've discovered you. And I was like, but I have to speak up, you know, like I have to be out there educating. It's what I've been doing. And I was very conflicted about it. And around the same time, all of a sudden, everybody started focusing on hands-free. Like, you know, it's okay if you use your phone just with your, you know, Bluetooth, you're not hurting anybody. And the reality is, like, there have been so many studies done that say that it's actually just as bad. Wow. I mean, common sense will tell you if you look down and touch your phone, that's more of a distraction, right? But actually holding your phone up to your ear or doing it with no like manual stimulation, your brain is still just as distracted. So now, like, I had to walk down the street and I would hear people, you know, like the very loud dial tone, you know, and then the ring, and I'd be like, oh shit, you know, like, why can't I say anything about this? Cause they think they're doing the right thing and they're actually not. I mean, I still have people call me sometimes. And, you know, yesterday someone called me who'd come to my book launch and was like a big fan of what I was doing. And she's like, oh, I'm going to put you on speaker so I don't cause any trouble. Oh. I'm on my way to a play. And I was like, are you walking? And she's like, oh, no, I'm driving. And I said, oh, no, I'm sorry. I don't do that. I mean, that's how I do it now. I just tell the person. And she said, oh, but I'm on Bluetooth. And I said, no, it's the same thing. Call me when you're stationary. And she never did call back, which maybe that's a good thing. I don't know.
Did you have to forgive the woman who caused the accident?
I have never been able to locate her. I did try. I did a story for Good Housekeeping when I started my project with the list. And I mean, ostensibly, it was actually about distracted driving. And they had accepted it when it was just about that. So that, I was really proud of that. But when I did try to inquire about her, the police officers I spoke with, which, by the way, not a fun experience. Yeah. The police officers who tried to resuscitate my dad remembered it. And this was 13 years later, like they remembered how bad it was. And they said she was a minor, so they couldn't give me any information about her. It was like illegal. And I've tried Googling her. I've tried finding her. Maybe someday she'll find me. I'm very open to that if she does. But, you know, regardless of whether I ever get a chance to forgive her in person, I forgave her in my heart when I learned about distracted driving, because, you know, I was going to these seminars and being shown, you know, slideshows and presentations about what happens to your brain and these tests they did on people. And, you know, the journalist in me was like, oh, okay, I get it. Like, this is a cognitive thing. And, you know, to be perfectly honest, the year that she killed my dad, I remember being in New York City, looking for an apartment and calling my husband, who was my boyfriend at the time, and being on the phone for almost the entire ride back to Delaware, you know, and I was 25. And she was 17. So at that time in 2003, like nobody knew anything about what phones do. So how could I, you know, how could I blame her for that?
It's weird that there's this 37-year-old woman who did something awful as a 17-year-old kid walking the earth. And you do sort of wonder whether she carries that with her, whether she put it suppressed in, but we just don't know.
But if she did something awful, so did I. I just happened to not hit anybody when I did it.
Yeah. I mean, we all have. We all have. That's a thing.
Yeah.
A lot of times we all have. All right. So I have your dad's list in front of me. And it's a quirky ass list of crazy things that I want to do, including, you know, play the piano or guitar, type 40 words a minute correctly, Paris, London, Vienna, own a black tux, own a $200 suit, send Joan on a $1,000 shopping spree, get to see a World Series game live, which your dad did. And one, it's actually funny because it's an obvious thing to have on a list like this, but you write about it so beautifully, is skydiving. And you went skydiving because, again, this is a book of your dad's bucket list. And you decided, I'm going to do all the things in my dad's bucket list. I just want to read real quick. You wrote, at first I screamed, but then I was okay because I was flying. I felt like Christopher Reeve on a green screen, except the scenery was all real. The bays and beaches and trees and highways and tiny little trucks moving along them were all real. I focus on the instructions, hold on to my straps, and extend my arms and smile. The rest was up to God now. Next thing I knew, Rohan and Nuclear George were twirling to the right of us, screaming all the way down. Jones pulled the ripcord, and our bodies jolted. "Welcome to my office," he yelled. "I think I might puke," I yelled. "I'm so sorry." "It's very common," he yelled back. This is one of the best things ever. My vomit floated midair, then some fell on me. When I landed, that puke would be on TV. I suspected that somewhere my dad was laughing. So you go skydiving in your dad's honor and you vomit all over yourself.
It was just an apple, thank God. I'd only eaten an apple that day.
Are there moments when you're doing these things, for example, skydiving, which again is a terrifying experience, and you're thinking, I don't really need to do this one. Like, okay, I know this is a list. I know it's for a book, but I don't need to do blank.
No, I had to do it. My husband didn't want me to do it for obvious reasons. and he has a fear of heights, actually. And my brother had already done it, actually, too. So, and when we first found the list, you know, we were in my brother's kitchen and he was really, he was as excited about it as I was. And he sort of was like, you know, like, I'm going to support you as you do this. And I didn't really know, like, you know, which ones yet he was going to do with me. And when that one came around, you know, and I was starting to understand better, you know, it's more like he was going to talk me through each list item I did, not necessarily like he was going to do them, although he did end up doing two of them. I felt like, okay, well, if that's the case, then even the ones he's already done, I feel like I need to do them too. And the other thing that happened was a news station, a local news station, Chasing News, had emailed me and said, we really want to cover you doing a list item. And, you know, they're here in New Jersey. And the only one I could think of was skydiving because it was going to be on TV. Like, you know, I'm not going to like type 40 words a minute correctly on TV, which was also a list item. So they are paying for it. And Rohan showed up and he was psyched. And his dad had actually just passed away too. And that's why he took on the segment. And it was actually a Father's Day segment, which is interesting because it's about to be Father's Day. So I did feel like I had to do it. I really felt like, okay, I'm going to do this death-defying thing because it's such a huge gesture that I felt like it would bring attention to why I was doing it. And after it was over, I talked like straight into the camera to the TV audience, which was also a list item, speak to a TV audience. Like I tried to like double or triple them up every time I could. Yeah. And I said, you know, as scary as this seemed today, it's not as scary as your dad dying because of a distracted driver. Like I really just wanted to hit home what that felt like. But I'm so, so, so happy I did that one, that I made that choice, because it turns out actually a lot of things that we think are really dangerous aren't as bad as we think they are. And you're much more likely to be killed driving down your street today than you are jumping out of an airplane.
When I went skydiving, it was about 10 years ago. I was absolutely terrified. I did it because I wanted to confront a fear. And I'm terrified. And my hands are soaked in sweat. And it's time. And they open the hatch. And they're like, all right, we're going to jump. You know, I'm attached to someone. But, you know, you flip and you go out backwards and the whole thing. But then you're just floating down. And you're like, this is the best thing ever.
Yeah. And it was like I was flying. It was like, you know, I was this very perfectionistic person as, you know, I was a copy editor, go figure, right? Like, I remember even before we got up into the plane, noticing that like a little corner of the parachute was hanging out of Jones's backpack, who is my tandem jumper, and saying, is that supposed to be like that? You know, as though like I'm going to be the one who saves my own life because I found a mistake. You know, it's like, it's fine. He just left such an impact on me that day because he told me he did that up to like 12 times a day, yeah, like every day. And he's like, that's why he said, welcome to my office. And he was just so like mellow and cool and laid back. And he's like, this is good for your brain. And I said, yeah, it really is, because after I survived it, I really had just had a new lease on life. I almost felt like, well, if I survived this, then I know I'm going to finish this list. And I was only on like what, item 5 or 6 at that point. But because I had done that so early and I survived it, I really felt like it was all going to be possible.
Another one your dad had was talk with the president was on the list. And I was kind of wondering, I mean, you alluded to this. Let's say somehow or another, you could have had an audience with Trump. Would that have been a no?
A no from me?
Yeah. Would you have met with?
No, of course not. I tried to get Trump. I try to get everybody. I wrote to Obama. I wrote to Biden. Well, Biden wasn't present yet, but I probably wrote to him anyway, just hoping I could capitalize on the Delaware connection.
And how did you get Jimmy Carter?
I was doing an Inside Edition interview just after the Good Housekeeping article that came out about my project and about distracted driving. And a man saw me on there. And, you know, they kind of joked around. They showed a picture of Trump in the interview. Oh, is she going to talk to him? And this guy wrote to me and he said, hey, you know, I just want you to know if any president will do Jimmy Carter still teaches Sunday school every Sunday in Plains, Georgia. So I looked into it and I'm thinking like, oh, maybe that will do, because when my dad wrote the list, it was 1978. So Jimmy Carter was the president he was talking about. You know, I actually found out later there was a brief time when Jimmy Carter was in the White House where I think it was Walter Cronkite. He did this program where he would field phone calls from civilians to the White House. And Jimmy Carter would actually talk to people. So I 100% think that my dad saw that and was like, that's how I'm going to get to talk to the president. I'm always kind of retracing his steps in 1978 to try to understand where these came from. But yeah, so we went down to Georgia. I had found out through a friend that I could get a guaranteed seat, like in a pew in the church. But there were no guarantees that I could talk to him. I met someone from the Carter Center who, because I was a journalist, she said, oh, I'm going to give you a private tour. So we did that. What really ended up helping us was, we went for this like late in the day sunset hike up Stone Mountain. And I was insisting that my husband do this with me because like Georgia was the only place my dad and my mom had been from the list. Like they had these great pictures where my dad was like holding his fist out triumphantly at the top of Stone Mountain. And I like had to recreate these pictures. By the time we finally got to our hotel, it was almost midnight. And it was like, because we got there at exactly the right moment, we met one of Jimmy Carter's biographers. He was standing right there. He had this great Jimmy Carter t-shirt. And I was just like, where did you get that? I want one. And we just hit it off and we started talking. And that's pretty soon we've been talking for 3 hours in front of our cars in the parking lot, just about Jimmy Carter and a little bit about Trump, but mostly about Jimmy Carter. He had a very unique perspective on what was happening in the US at the time, which, you know, back in August 2017, everybody was trying to take down Confederate statues. And they were dealing with that in Canada too. So we kind of talked about that. And I was able to hold my own on Jimmy Carter because I'd spent 2 weeks binging every single piece of information I could find on him, you know, as any good journalist would do. And the next day we ran into Art again, and he had told us he'd also met Bill Clinton. He'd also met he'd met George H.W. Bush. I Googled him that night and there he was with every single one of them. There was a picture of Jimmy Carter in his kitchen because Jimmy Carter actually slept in his house. So when we ran into him that weekend, the next day, he's like, well, you know, if Carter could sign anything for you, what would it be? He kept asking us all these like leading questions. Like, don't you think he knows you're here? It was so weird. So by the time we finally got to the church, I had some peace of mind that maybe this like mysterious man had done something to help us. And then he came in and he sat down right next to him. It was so, I was like, oh my God, almost like he's like a president whisperer. And after the amazing Sunday school sermon, which really what he taught us that day changed my life, we walked right up and I got to have a few sentences with him, which people don't get generally because they warn you, like, don't bother him. You know, like he'll take a picture with you, but really like move it along. So I felt very lucky. And you know, again, that was very similar to the skydiving in that it was one of the most impossible ones. And there were so many miraculous things that happened that made me start to believe there's something bigger than me here. Like I think my dad's helping me, you know, like his spirit might still exist somewhere. That really, so it was changing my faith too.
What was it about Jimmy Carter's sermon that did it for you?
At that time I was really starting to consider writing this book. And I was very nervous about it because it's, you know, as a journalist, you write about other people. You don't write about yourself. And I wasn't so worried about writing about my own life and my own childhood, which was wonderful, by the way. But I knew I had to write about my depression as a teenager because it was kind of a strained time with my dad. And I didn't want to write anything about that made my mom feel bad, you know, and I didn't want to write anything that made my brother feel bad. It's like I wanted to protect them because I'm very protective of my family. So I really just felt like, do I have permission to do this? Because I'm feeling called to live this and write this story. And Carter gave this sermon about how, if you want to live a good life, he said, it's up to you to shape it. It's up to you to decide how you're going to live. And you can't let your parents shape your life for you. And, you know, kids can't shape their parents' lives, and you can't shape your spouse's life, and your spouse can't shape your life. And he said, ultimately, the only thing that can shape your life is God. Like, the only co-creator you should have is someone who knows everything and can do anything, and you have constant access to him. And there was something about the way he said it that was very liberating for me, because I didn't feel so alone in my decisions and my choices. And it occurred to me, well, maybe this whole idea for this book and this list, maybe it came along because of something bigger than me, like I said, and maybe there's something guiding me as I do this, and I can feel permission to continue exploring this without so much fear and guilt. And really, I still live that way. I still feel like, yes, you know, I have free will. The things I'm doing are up to me. My life is not just like fated, but I still have, you know, the universe, God, whatever people believe in, I have something on my side that's also showing me the way if I can't figure something out.
When you write a book like this, one of the risks, by inevitable risks, is that you learn things about people you didn't know that maybe you'd rather not know. You know, what was something you learned about your dad that you never knew and maybe could have done without?
That's a really good question. I don't know that this is something I could have done without, but you know, the thing that's interesting when somebody dies like this is, and you start to talk more to the people who knew them, you start learning more, like you just, like the stories never end. You keep learning more and more throughout your life. And I just learned something new Wednesday night at my book launch that it didn't make it into the book. And of course, when my mom told me, I'm like, this would have been helpful, you know, before. Because during the book launch, the moderator said to me, well, what kind of bag was it that you found the list in? And this whole time I've been describing it as almost like a little suede pouch with marbles, like one that's made for marbles. But now I think it was probably for dice because he loved backgammon. And my mom goes later after the launch, she says, well, you know what that was? And I said, no, what was it? And she said, well, that was your uncle, like my dad's brother. He found the list and my dad's driver's license and, you know, the ring he was wearing. He put all of that stuff into this little pouch. And that means all of these things were given to him by the coroner. So they were on my dad, which means my dad probably carried that list with him everywhere he went, like his entire life.
Wow, interesting.
Like that means, like, think about how many times was I around the list, you know, for 25 years and didn't know, because it was probably folded up in his wallet and he would probably pull it out and check it off when something happened. So I don't know if I should be happy about that or really sad, because it's like, this whole time, the list was this foreign, mysterious object that I now have framed on my bedroom wall. And people treat the frame like it's the Ark of the Covenant or something, like they don't want to touch it. But my dad, it was just so significant. And I mean, now I feel like it kind of makes sense that, you know, people like psychics especially always say things like, oh, well, your loved one is communicating with you because you have their ring, or, you know, you have something that they carried on their body all the time. I never understand that though. Like, why do they want to hang around the thing that they owned? But it makes sense in this case that by looking at that list and really studying it for 6 years, I would feel so much closer to him and more inclined to believe in him and trust his motivations, because this was kind of his Bible if he carried it with him everywhere he went.
What felt like the most, like, why is this on the list? Why am I doing this thing? Like, of all the things on the list, we're like,
all of the sporting events.
Really? Rose Bowl? Rose Bowl didn't do it for you? Go to the Rose Bowl.
It did, but not when I was first there. You know, my dad used to always joke, in one ear, out the other, because he and my brother bonded over sports and I would just tune out. They were the type who knew everything about sports, knew they were like almanacs. Like, my brother can just cite statistics and every score of every game that's ever happened. And, you know, I thought it was the most boring thing in the world. And I probably was like the most reluctant Rose Bowl and Super Bowl attendant you'd ever meet. And yet, when I was there, it was incredible. I mean, of course, it turned out to be the first Rose Bowl ever to go into double overtime. At halftime, I had actually prayed, please let Georgia win, because now Georgia was my team because I had just met Jimmy Carter. For no other reason. And I said, please make the score the age you were when you died. And I knew that wasn't possible. Like, no Rose Bowl has a score of 54. But then it went into double overtime and it happened. Like I looked up at the scoreboard and it said 54. It was like unbelievable. And then, you know, when I went to the Super Bowl, I think I barely even knew who was playing. I knew it was the 49ers. I think it was Kansas City was the other one. And it was like, God, I'm such a disgrace to sports fans everywhere, you know? And it was so funny because I went by myself because the ticket was like $5,000 and it was like the worst seat in the house, but hey, I got one. And I was sitting there next to these two guys who were there with their sons. And they were like explaining the game to me as though just because, you know, I told them why I was there. They just assumed I didn't, because I was like, oh, how did that happen? Because I was like pissed off that Kansas City had scored. And they're like, well, let me tell you. And they're like explaining football, which I thought was hilarious. The best part about that story, I think, is like later that night, my husband came and picked me up. And he said, oh, yeah, I was in the elevator in the hotel. And I told a guy my wife's at the Super Bowl. And he looked at me and he said, when's the divorce?
That's awesome.
I thought I was going to hate those things. I thought I was going to hate the Final Four too, even though I did play basketball in high school. I like basketball. And I was shocked to learn how amazing it was and how exciting it was. Like when you watch athletes at that level, and I loved learning their life stories, you know, like that's really how I ended up approaching writing about it. I just the heroes these guys were.
Before we continue at Two Writers Slinging Yang, a quick word from our sponsor.
Hey, this is Jeff Perlman. I'm here with my daughter, Casey, and it's Father's Day.
I wrote you a note to express my feelings.
Would you mind reading it?
Dear Dad, I'm so lucky you're my father. You're the best dad ever.
Oh my God, this is so sweet.
I mean, you smell like one of those dead sea lions who's been left in the sun for a week, and you're unathletic, and you always complain. And, to be honest, I don't like you.
Wait, what?
But thanks to you and this stupid podcast, I've come to love RoyalRetros.com. And I go there all the time for my favorite throwback t-shirts, hats, and sweatshirts. Love, Casey.
I don't really know what to say.
Let me ask you a final question. You go on this epic journey to write this book. It takes you years to do. It's a deeply emotional and personal topic. The book came out a couple of days ago. I always feel when my books come out, a sense of joy mixed with a little bit of an underwhelming, oh, so that's it. All that work. Here it is. It's out. I wonder how you are feeling now that this book, this epic journey about your late father who died tragically and you went all over and everywhere and up and down and left and right, the book comes out. Do you feel complete or do you feel a little, oh, so that's it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. There's very little, oh, so that's it for me. Because, you know, look, you're a real book author. Okay.
Or like you.
Well, I guess technically, but but you know, you've done this a few times. You know, like you've studied it, like you understand it, you know how it works. I've worked as a copy editor of magazines my whole career, mostly. I've done some writing here and there, but only as inspiration struck. And if I got lucky, sometimes it takes a year to even get an article published. I always call it a miracle if it happens at all. So approaching this, I did not in any way think of myself as a book author. I just thought it's a list item, right? And have a few novels published. It's a list item. I can't back out. It's just like skydiving, right? Like I had to do it, even if it was going to be awful. You know, I'm like, I used to always say, it doesn't have to be three good novels or a few good novels. It just has to be novels. So my goal the whole time has just been to finish. If I can get the book published, get it written, I've accomplished it. If people like it and it's actually good, great. That's a bonus, but it's kind of freeing for me, right? Because I don't have any ego attachment to this. So I'm not looking at this as like, oh, if lots of people buy it, that means I'm a good writer, or it's some kind of statement on me or my career. Because I also look at the list as like, God, like a magical boon that fell into my lap. You know, it's like a blessing. And I was just the vehicle to carry it out. So if I'm proud of my writing in this, it's really just to honor my dad, who was such a great writer. And I hope that I lived up to that. And I feel really good about it. Like, I just feel like, you know, this is going to end up being mostly for people who've experienced loss that they're not sure how to cope with. And maybe I might shake them awake a little bit and help them to enjoy living again, because that's what I went through. And I'm really happy and relieved now that I'm at these book signings and I'm meeting people. I'm so relieved I was brave enough to talk about that, because I spent 10 years not talking about it and kind of living half a life. And that's no way to, I mean, my dad would not want me to be like that. He would want me to be like really feeling alive and going on these adventures. And, you know, I really figured out who I really am doing this. Like, I didn't know I was this adventurous person, and now I do. So I view this almost as an end, but also a beginning for whatever books I'm going to write next. And, you know, I have my own list now, so I'm really excited about those adventures.
Let me ask you a final trivia question. Where did the current president of the United States go to college? A, Stanford, B, Harvard, or C, the University of Delaware?
C. So
that's pretty cool. That is
pretty cool. My dad went to high school with him.
He did?
His oldest brother, Tom, was in Joe Biden's graduating high school class.
There you go. You know what? Did we go to the best college in America? No. Did we go to the coolest college in America? No. Did we go to the college where the sitting president attended? We did, Laura. We did. I just want to say, the book is great. It's an amazing idea for a book. I love that you went through with it. I think it's such an amazing honor to your dad and homage to your dad. And congrats on getting it done. It's a huge accomplishment. You should feel really good about this.
Thank you so much. And, you know, there's something about talking to you that's really making me realize how much my University of Delaware training helped me.
Oh, yeah. There you go.
Every topic I learned in Ben Yagoda's class is in this book.
There you go.
And Dennis Jackson and McKay Jenkins.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
No, I appreciate you. Thank you so much for having me.
I want to thank today's guest, Laura Carney, for joining me on Two Writers Sing and Yang. And follow Laura on Twitter at LAC30 and visit her website, buylauracarney.com. And My Father's List, How Living My Dad's Dream Set Me Free, is available wherever books are sold. If you have a chance and enjoy Two Writers Sing and Yang, please go to the vehicle of your choice and leave a nice review. I'd be really appreciative. Music is by the fantastic MC White Owl. Thanks again for joining me. And remember, keep writing.